here.
Yep, we're bona fide professionals now.
We're right.
All
right.
We put a whole $30 into this podcast.
Sweet.
Yeah, but it'll probably make it easier now. We don't have to like fumble around with this and then our notes and then our microphone. So
hands-free devices.
Yep. But do you want to get us started?
Yeah. Welcome back to the Trade Writers Podcast, a podcast where we review a different trade paperback every week. This week we have a very special guest, my brother Nathan. How's it going today?
It's going very well. How are you?
Good, good.
And that's it.
Yeah. And so what are we
reading? Woo, Nathan!
And
we have
returning guest, Chip Zdarsky. How's it going today?
Pretty good. How are you?
Good, good.
Good. Just hustling. We had to put the rest of the notes on there, but we are ready to go.
Sweet.
So today we're going to be talking about Spider-Man Life Story, a little book that international writer Chip Zdarsky did with a little artist named Mark Bagley. Is that how you say it?
I believe so. It's one of those things, working with the artist, like I never actually know. Is it Chris Bacallo? Chris Bacallo? I work with Marco on Daredevil. I have no idea if it's Chicano, Cacano, Cachetto.
Yeah, that's a tough one.
Yeah.
Are we pronouncing Zdarsky right?
Yes. I think so. Anyways, it's a fake name, so I have no idea.
Yeah.
Yeah, why is that? I'm just kind of curious. Is your birth name a little boring to you? Or?
No, I was in a situation where I was working for two newspapers, and I kind of pissed off one of the newspapers, and I told them that I would do any work that would bring disrepute to my good name. I would do it under a different name to not offend them anymore. And I started doing comics under that just to keep it separate. But I didn't realize, 25 years later, I'd still be doing it.
Right.
Yeah. Yep. I love the name. I love when some comics are starting to come back, which is nice. But I love when you have your double dip Chip weeks.
Yeah.
Which is two Chip Zdarsky books come out in the same week.
Yeah. It'll be a while before we're back up to the double dippers.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah. Hopefully one day.
Do you have a favorite dip or chip?
Well, okay. So here's the thing. So about 4 months ago, I went vegan. Don't recommend it, but I didn't realize it, but like I'm a basic guy, obviously. And my favorite chips were plain Ruffles, just plain Ruffles.
Sure.
Love them.
Classic.
They have milk in them.
Really?
Milk. The ingredients on the plain Ruffles is quite long. So
yeah.
During the quarantine, I switched over to a basic Lay's potato chips because I know there's nothing untoward in those. It's just like chip, salt, oil. You're done.
Yeah, it's good.
And no dip. I like my chips dry. I like them just to scrape right down my throat.
Perfect.
Nice.
Yeah.
Dry dog. Well, let's talk about Spider-Man Life Story. Do you want to give just the basic kind of pitch for it? It's a very complex pitch, but you would do it justice better than I.
If you're a Marvel Comics reader, you kind of understand that there's a sliding timeline involved. Characters don't really age, but the world changes around them. That's the way it's been since Spider-Man went into college, basically. Like the thing that separated Marvel from DC at the beginning was the fact that the characters aged. Like Peter Parker went from a nerdy 15-year-old to like this college hunk. and at some point, Marvel was like, what are we doing? These characters will be 80 before we know it. So they put the brakes on it. So what this book does is it reimagines Spider-Man as if they didn't put the brakes on it and he continued to age based on his first appearance in 62. So, yeah, right. we chart his life up against the events that happened in the world and the events that happened in the Spider-Man comics during the decades that they happened, but he and his supporting cast age.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And you have Mark Bagley on art for this, which I think is a perfect choice considering he's a veteran artist in general, but also a veteran Spider-Man artist. What a perfect choice.
I know.
How did all that come together?
Well, I had kind of a pitch for like a 12-issue kind of big Marvel series. So not Spider-Man focused, but it was supposed to be about basically everyone in the Marvel Universe.
Okay.
I pitched it to an editor, Tom Brevoort, and he liked the pitch because he was toying with the idea himself, but he said you have to have focus. Like, you need a entry character. And he suggested just doing it as Spider-Man because I had just finished Spectacular Spider-Man. So people still wanted me to do Spider-Man stuff. It took a bit of convincing, but I realized he's correct. And the farther I got into it, I realized he's really correct. Like, there's no way I could have done this for the Marvel Universe. It just would have been impossible to cram all the characters in. So at that point, Marvel wanted to get on the schedule as quickly as they could. They had like a gap, and I needed each issue to be at least 30 pages instead of the regular 20 to kind of get everything I need into it. So with those restrictions, we were actually really limited in what artists we could use. So we were super lucky that Mark had just finished a book and needed a new project, because he's the only artist Marvel has that could have done this on time.
Really?
He's so fast. It actually gave me anxiety how fast he is. Sometimes you say, you know, an artist will send a page in, you're like, oh, that's nice. And then a couple of days later, another page, and okay. And you kind of like look at your watch and your calendar to figure out when the next script will be due. Mm-hmm. With Mark, it was like 2 pages a day, pencils, full pencils, just boom, wow. Boom, boom, boom. There's nothing I could throw at him to slow him down.
And there's a lot.
It's a dense book too, like a lot of designs and stuff. And he just kind of designs on the page and just kind of rolls with it because he's such a pro. So I would just have these nightmares that I was going to fall behind him because he's just super prolific.
Well, there's also a lot on your end too, trying to track everything that's kind of going on in Spider-Man at the time and how to weave that into a story. So
like the research stage was epic. Like, it took a long time to figure it all out, but then writing was really, really hard, like to make it work as a narrative and to check up all these boxes I've kind of created in my head that it needed to do was a lot. So I stayed ahead of them by a full issue through the whole run, so I'm super proud of that. it was surreal having Mark Bagley art show up in my inbox. Like, it's that weird thing. Like, you know, I read his stuff in Amazing Spider-Man as a kid. As a young adult, I loved Ultimate Spider-Man.
Right.
It's the character he's like so associated with, and he was born to draw, and he loves drawing Spider-Man. So, really worked out well.
Yeah, it doesn't cut any corners or anything either. These are like full backgrounds and foregrounds and everything. So that's impressive to hear that he was doing two a day.
He's... And when I would ask for a change, like, sometimes he'd be like, something would be off in a panel, and, you know, I'd be like, I don't want to get him to redraw the panel, but like, hey, this is actually important to change this. Like, 20 minutes later, all of a sudden there'd be like a fix in, like, crazy nice. Fast. Yeah.
So we'll jump right in. So the way that it was structured is that each issue was a different decade, starting with the 60s. So Spider-Man became Spider-Man in 1962, but the book starts in 1966.
Yeah.
So he's kind of been Spider-Maning around for quite a bit. Were you thinking about starting at the origin, or did you kind of figure like people get it and like we'll just kind of go?
Yeah, there were a couple of problems with starting there. One is, like I said before, they were already doing the real-time stuff. So nothing would be different, really. Like, you'd just be following him along in basically the same situation. So I knew I wanted to pick up a little bit later and just kind of have hints of the origin in the first page or two. Because, everyone knows the origin. That's kind of a lock. And if we could drop in on his college days, it would make it a lot easier kind of going forward.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, nice. So the whole first issue kind of has Spider-Man pondering whether or not to enlist in the Vietnam War, and whether to use his powers to make a difference at the expense of a secret identity, like whether to enlist or not or whatever. And those are kind of thoughts that are enforced by seeing Iron Man on the news, helping save American lives and stuff. And also Cap is kind of mentioned on the news.
Mm-hmm.
And then again, like Flash's party. So the whole first issue, he's kind of wondering like whether he should be using his powers to fight in this war and everything. And then you also have the typical Spider-Man stuff going on. So like Norman Osborn likes Peter more than Harry, and he's always late to school, and there's starting like a relationship with Gwen and everything. So then I had one of my questions was how much did you know about like American history? Cause it plays quite a big role in all this, or did you have to go into a lot of that? Cause you're in Canada, you're Canadian. So how much did you know?
I mean, in Canada, we get a fair amount of American history just through the media. So I knew enough about Vietnam War to know that I wanted to tackle it, and I did a bit of research for the issue just to make sure I wasn't doing anything wrong. My neighbor's a Vietnam War guy as well. He's a high school teacher, so I would run stuff by him once in a while. Cool. In the comics, like the war featured heavily around Flash Thompson. And even then, they kind of like, you know, their character's condemning it, but he's kind of a hero for going. And like, it was political, but it wasn't super political. And there was no question about like Spider-Man going off to fight in the war. And that's a result of, you know, Marvel's publishing these comics. Like, you can't take really a hard stance in comic books at the time. Mm-hmm. So, part of what I wanted to do with the series was just kind of ignore the idea that the corporation would stop storylines, because in the 60s, there's so little to change, because again, the ages haven't really shifted enough in that decade to have it make a huge impact. So there were little changes, and I figured a focus on the Vietnam War and having him question it a bit more, especially knowing I could play with characters like Captain America and Iron Man, because if we're doing the real-time thing with them, then they would definitely have more involvement in that war.
So at this point of the podcast, the audio started to get super like choppy and kind of unlistenable. So we lost about 2 minutes there, but that's fine, because all that really happened was that I was mentioning a joke that Chip made, and I just totally butchered it. And so we are now going into the second part of it, and everything seemed pretty good from there. So
that's I think it was trying to record. Look,
I was just saying, like, based off of like the time and kind of how it was written, like Spider-Man being in between going to war or not, it's kind of almost up to the reader as well, like what your stance is on that, because it is kind of pros and cons to both, because he's kind of more of a protector of humanity, not necessarily like America specifically. So
it's also easier writing it from 2019 versus in the 60s, because with time we all look back at the Vietnam War, we're like, oh yeah, no, that was fucked up, like you know, they sent a lot of kids to die for no reason, really. At the time, it wasn't as clear cut for obviously the American population. So that makes it a lot easier, I think.
Yeah. And so continuing on in the story, Flash Thompson is having a going away party. He's going to the Vietnam War. Obviously, they have a history, but they kind of overcome it a little bit. But also at that party, you find out that Norman knows that Peter is Spider-Man, and he also turns into the Green Goblin at that point.
Yeah.
And so that kind of gets resolved. There's a pretty awesome action scene, and he kind of goes back into the when Norman is Green Goblin, then he kind of knows what's going on, but when he's out, then he doesn't know that he's Green Goblin. At least that's what it seems.
That was a thing they played with a lot during that time period. You know, there's some of that is pretty much lifted from the 60s issues. It was like Norman waking up and like Peter having to dress him in his clothes.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of, the hair is pretty noticeably 60s for Norman and Harry. What's your take on that?
Is that your idea?
That the hair is 60s?
Yeah,
like,
so like
the comb over, like how it's like portrayed in like a comic book, it almost looks like cornrows, but it's really just like the fins of the teeth of a comb, like shading.
It was not in my script, so that would be all Bagley.
Yeah, I noticed that, and I was like, what is that? And then I just like, yeah, I guess that's kind of how it was in the 60s, but it's kind of a neat effect at the same time that he kind of looked into that.
So
Peter sends an anonymous tip on Norman Osborn being the Green Goblin. Peter thinks that he should also be a better friend to Harry and stuff, but he realizes that after the party, it's already the day that Flash is departing, and so he leaves to go and try and catch him before he's actually about to leave. And Gwen's there saying he's a bad friend because he's always late and whatever. And then finds out that he's Spider-Man.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Just one button.
So I, knowing in the 60s that there wasn't a lot I could really change, I kind of thought that, again, just thinking without the restrictions of Marvel protecting the characters, that realistically Peter would turn in Norman.
Mm-hmm.
Like, in the comics, he doesn't. Like, Norman doesn't go to jail or anything at that point because Marvel wanted to keep that going. That kind of the dual identity and bring him back. So I like the idea of him being kind of a bit more final with that. And for Gwen to figure out who he is at that stage. Just by kind of creating the standard kind of Parker luck issue with him being late to see Flash off and having that kind of level of regret, which kind of plays out through the whole series.
Mm. And then we kind of jump to a year later. Captain America said that he was going to Vietnam to kind of learn a little bit more. Mm. And you kind of see that he's not really taking either side. He's just trying to protect lives wherever he can, which was a very cool thing. And I think that kind of, he's very directly like calling out Iron Man, which plays a part obviously later down in the story, but I think that was a cool addition, and that was the end of the first issue.
So. Yeah, I think a character like Tony Stark, if you read the early Iron Man appearances, like he's very pro America, and I wanted to kind of stay true to that arc. Like, he was kind of rewritten over the years to kind of change that character to something a bit more palatable. But kind of keeping him as not a villain, but like a guy with a very clear line, I think helped everything. And it's funny that scene with Cap didn't exist in the script originally. I was gonna like allude to it in issue two, but I remember I sent Nick Spencer the script issue one. And he was like, "Ah, this is great, but I kind of want to see Cap and Nom." I'm like, he's right. Because it is the one thing in there that really makes you go, oh, this is different. This is wow. Because up until that point, like I said, because of the time stuff, not a lot is different. Gwen finding out, okay, sure. Norman going to jail, all right. But like Cap, like just looking crazy in Vietnam was like kind of a way to sell this as a big Marvel Universe thing.
Yeah, that's a big, I think, distinguishable difference. Was the first issue hardest to write, do you think? Just kind of getting everything going?
I don't think so. I think the 80s one was the hardest.
Gotcha.
Just because they're the comics I grew up with. So I kind of wanted to put everything into it, and that became really hard. There's a lot of cutting back. The 60s is pretty straightforward. Like once you kind of get the rhythm of it, I think it was, if not easy, it was probably the easiest.
Okay.
Yeah,
that makes sense.
I feel like it would get harder as you go on, because it's like technically like a different continuity that this is going on. So you're just like building everything on top of each other. And I feel like as it goes on, it would get a little bit more dense and you have to kind of keep track of everything that you're doing.
Yeah, you definitely, there was a lot of planning involved with this. Like, you know, I didn't start writing issue one until I kind of knew everything that was going to happen in each issue.
Yeah. Okay.
Because the plot it all out, like, between me and the editor, like it was a huge document going back and forth with ideas, what works, what doesn't work, and then to kind of arrange them all on timelines to make sure narratively you can do it and page count you can do it, because that was the big restriction.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
So jumping into issue two, we got the 70s. At this era, this is kind of when the original Clone Saga happened.
Mm-hmm.
What were some of the other ones that were touched on in this? Just because I haven't read all the Spider-Man 70s, 80s and stuff. So the Clone Saga one is the most apparent one to me. But do you know what
else?
Yeah,
kind of. I'm trying to think if there's anything like the Jackal, the clone stuff is definitely the main thing. Gwen's death is mm-hmm. the other one. Like I didn't want to do a recreation of the bridge stuff because
right.
it's been overdone and people would see it coming a mile away. So having to kind of twist at the end that that Gwen and not the clone died, that felt important to me. And after that, there's the scene with Mary Jane just being there for Peter. Peter yelling at her, but she stays. That's a very direct lift from after Gwen Stacy dies in the original storyline. It was really impactful, too, because up to that point, you didn't really see kind of scenes without dialogue. And the original scene is like Peter yelling at Mary Jane, "You're a party girl, like, you know, get out of here." And it's like MJ about to leave and her just kind of closing the door and staying with Peter. But it's silent in the original. And I love that so much. So the end of this is basically that. I didn't do it silent. But
yeah,
it's pretty direct lift to that.
Yeah. So the clone stuff that happens is that it's always interesting to explain, but Gwen's working with Miles Warren at her lab, but that's secretly being funded by Norman Osborn at Oscorp. Mm-hmm. And so at the end of the issue, Spider-Man goes there because the Black Goblin, who's actually Harry, barges in, which is that something that exists in comics or is that a new thing?
Black Goblin is a new thing, but the idea of
okay.
Harry becoming Green Goblin is a thing that happened.
Right.
Many times. So I kind of wanted to make it a bit more distinct and to add the kind of a new design element to it as well, just so Mark would have something interesting to play with
yeah.
and the colorists could play with it.
I think it looks great.
It looks so sick.
Yeah.
Big fan.
Yeah, yeah. It was super fun. Like I remember describing it being like, oh, this is going to look so cool on the page. So that was fun to add.
Yeah. So Spider-Man's there to fight him off, but we find out that Warren made a clone of Norman Osborn like he was supposed to, but he also ended up making a clone of Peter and Gwen on his own. Mm-hmm. So that ends up becoming so Peter and Black Goblin end up keep fighting. And so, hold on.
And the Black Goblin like throws like one of the pumpkin grenades in to kill the clones, and then ends up turning out that Gwen is actually in there, like the original one, and then the one that's been working with Miles was the clone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Two twists in one.
Yeah, because you know, in the original Clone Saga, like Miles was in love with Gwen, that's why he cloned her.
Right.
After her death. So here I wanted it to be like Peter can have the clone, like that's the one that's walking around thinking she's Gwen, and he has her like trapped in this mm-hmm. stasis, which I felt yeah. was like yeah a decent way to kind of deliver a twist to the reader.
Yeah, it was definitely pretty trippy to read. And then the Norman Osborn clone died along with original Gwen, but the Peter clone stayed alive because he still has the proportional like powers of Spider-Man. Yeah. So he survives. So that's kind of what happened there.
And then like the clone Peter Parker and then the clone Gwen, who we didn't know was the clone Gwen until the end. They like leave and then there it's Ben and then.
Yeah. So a year after that, it's the clone Peter and clone Gwen decide to make a life for themselves as Ben and Helen Parker. Was Helen Parker a new thing or was that already?
It was a new thing. I can't recall if I grabbed it from something else. It's pretty rare that I name a character and it doesn't mean something else.
Right.
But I can't recall right now what that's in reference to. Oh, I think it's like Aunt May's mom's name, maybe. It's something like that.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Just because Ben.
I try to avoid too much. Like in comics, it's always like somebody has a kid and they're either named after them or they're named after like their their parent or something like that. And
yeah,
I wanted to make sure that it was distinct because like later on when we, you know, there's a series, an alternate universe series, Spider-Girl, in which like Peter Parker and MJ's kid was named May, of course. And I kind of want to avoid that because that happens in real life, but it happens so much in comics, you know?
Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
So yeah, Helen is felt far removed, I think.
Deeper cut.
Yeah.
Yep. A little bit earlier in the issue, we find out that MJ is married to Harry, and MJ kind of calls him out on being Spider-Man and not doing everything he could to save Flash as a powered man. I kind of had a little bit of a question about that because at the very, very opening scene,
he's talking to a grave.
Yeah, Peter's staring at Flash Thompson's grave, saying, kind of blaming himself. Do you think that there's more story there, or do you think he's referring back to he could have stopped him from going to the Vietnam War in the first place?
He could have stopped him from going. He could have gone himself.
Okay.
So there's both those things, and you know it that idea of like who are you responsible to kind of boils over when we find out, you know, he's working for Reed Richards as well, and
right,
they have that big discussion over the responsibility to the rest of the world. And it was kind of a later retcon where we discovered that like Mary Jane kind of always knew he was Spider-Man, like in the regular continuity.
Right.
Because she lived next door to him, so she saw him like come and go as Spider-Man.
Which makes sense.
So yeah, so it felt like an appropriate time for her to reveal it instead of like so much later in the Amazing Spider-Man run when they decided that was the case.
Yeah. Yeah, the relationship of Peter and Reed, and this is really interesting because Reed's starting to kind of use his sense of responsibility to like push away his wife and his like friends. And so it's kind of implied that Invisible Woman's going is with Namor right now. Yeah. Is that the case?
Yeah.
So, and that's kind of a thing that weighs on Peter a lot is like the balance of using your power and like when should you like use it for yourself? Like Captain America kind of says like you're doing good, or when should you use this to help the greater good? So that's an interesting theme throughout that gets visits throughout the whole book.
Yeah.
Let's see. Yeah, I think that's everything. Oh, actually, we see a new design for Spider-Man's suit. And we find that there's kind of a new design for every issue.
That's one of my favorite parts for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Which kind of wraps all together at the end. But was that all Bagley, or did you have like kind of an idea of what you wanted to do throughout each of the books?
I would give him general notes. Usually kind of based on the era. Bagley originally didn't want him to change costumes at all. Like he wanted him to kind of keep the same one all throughout his career. I think that mostly it's because Bagley really enjoys drawing that costume.
Right.
And then, you know, I justified it by saying like in the real world, like he would be updating it. He would be changing it. Like you wouldn't wear the same leotard from when you were 15. Like I would wear
accommodations. And
I don't wear the same clothes I wore when I was 15. Like, and,
that makes sense.
Yeah, by the time he's like 50, like he's not going to be in skin tight outfit. And I want him to change shape a little bit by the end as well, which was another kind of discussion with Bagley. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I would give him some notes and some guidance as to what I wanted. And then he kind of like came up with his own ideas and took some of those as well. Yeah, it's best to just kind of stay out of his way, let him do what he does best.
Yeah, it looks great. Just the random like armor plates and stuff that's on there.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
It's awesome. Is there anything else you wanted to showcase in this issue?
In issue 2? No, I think that covers it. Yeah.
Yeah, cool. So we'll go to issue 3, which is the 80s. Mm-hmm. So this is during the events of Secret Wars. So yeah. Peter is off planet along with a bunch of other heroes.
Yeah.
I think this might be probably my favorite one of the whole series, just because there's a lot of interesting stuff that happens. So it kind of opens up with Peter's gone while MJ is going into labor with no idea where Parker's been for 3 weeks. So that's because everything's going on with Secret Wars. And when we jump over to the Secret Wars sort of scene, there's an amazing double page spread of everything that's happening.
That was fun. Even as I was writing that spread, I was just like, oh, this is going to be the coolest thing when it comes in. Like, just to see Bagley. Because that was my first comic when I was a kid, was Secret Wars.
Oh, and cool.
So to get to revisit that with like a cool artist like Bagley is was really, really fun. So, you know, for that spread, like I basically told him where I thought each character would be at this point in terms of what they'd be wearing, what their, you know, their age, their fashion choices.
Right.
And then, he just went hog wild. Like, the pencils are so good on this. Like, the final looks good, but his pencils on this one were just unbelievable. Yeah.
I can't even imagine.
I'll say, too, like, because it's the 80s issue, page one, I did it on a 9-panel grid to evoke Watchmen. Ooh.
Watchmen. Okay, cool. I didn't
because that was a big thing of the 80s, and then Rorschach analog shows up as well when the black costume Spider-Man comes out of the construct.
Okay, cool. Yeah. I noticed in this double page there's a lot of characters that you can't like. It's not super noticeable like the age difference, but it kind of focuses on Reed and sort of Otto at the same time. I thought that was kind of interesting. I don't know if that was on purpose, just to not have to age everybody up or whatever, but.
Well, I mean, a lot of it was just figuring out, like, I had a separate timeline just to figure out what people's ages would be, because.
Yeah.
My rule was, is based on their first appearance. Like, if a character's first appearance, they're 20 and it's 1970. Mm-hmm. Then okay, that's where we start with them and start to age them up. So some of these characters just naturally haven't aged as much,
right? Like
Wolverine just doesn't age, so that made sense. Cap had the super soldier serum, so I was trying to keep him young. And most other characters are super powered or immortal, and you can't really tell.
Yeah, very cool. Yeah, we also see on the next page. Spider-Man's suit's kind of more mechanical now, which kind of makes sense. He's starting to get a little bit older and everything. But as he's fixing it, he ends up finding this thing that repairs suits for people, but ends up being the symbiote.
Yeah.
What we find later, we find the famous black Spider-Man suit.
Yeah.
So, which he does a great black Spider-Man. It just looks incredible.
Yeah, he really does. He's the best.
So then we see two more weeks go by. Peter finally gets back to MJ in his new suit to find his two twin children.
Yeah.
It's Claire and Benjamin. Mm-hmm. Benjamin kind of seems like a good name.
That was my concession to naming them after May or Benji.
So then where did Claire come in?
I think Claire was just me making up a name, frankly.
Okay.
Just to make it its own thing.
I like how he's referred to as Benji for the rest of it. Then that kind of like separates him, and then you know who you're talking about.
Yeah, exactly.
You then also find out that since most of the superheroes disappeared because of Secret Wars, It was during the Cold War at this time. So when most of the heroes disappeared, Russia was able to attack with these like intangible missiles. And so Vision was there on Earth trying to stop that. And he was trying to redirect him. And he redirected them from Manhattan to Pennsylvania, where he witnessed the explosion happen, you know, from the heart of it. And it shows that he's still intangible to this day, just kind of staring. We don't know if it's like a malfunction or a psychological thing. I thought that was super just creative, but do you...
Thanks.
Was there more to that, do you think? Or was that just kind of like a cool thing that's happening?
Spin-up series.
Yeah.
I mean that whole scene was basically me trying to figure out world events and how it would affect this time period. Mm-hmm. Because, it would be an opening for Russia. And I just knew it would be such a cool visual to just, like, have Vision just, like...
It's great, yeah.
Just, like, in this wasteland.
And, the art just makes him seem more so just, like, kind of empty inside, but he's obviously still there. It's awesome.
Yeah, you know, you wanted to see what happens when all the superheroes disappear. Like, it wouldn't just be, like, business as usual. Mm-hmm. I knew Mark would just kill it. And again, like, we only had like 2 pages to basically tell that,
say that.
Short story, really, about mm-hmm. what happened. So devoting a whole page to the Vision was tricky narratively, but I think it was worth it.
Super effective.
Who is this next division? Is that supposed to be?
Oh, it's Peter just reaching his hand
during the actual like
while the
oh during that line. That's Invisible Girl.
Okay.
She was right. Left behind
in her solo costume, I guess.
At that point, like, she's not part of Fantastic Four, so that was my only
that's a whole new design.
Okay,
cool.
Mark was just have her be herself.
Yep, cool. So after the facts, after that whole Vision thing, Reed and Peter are talking. So Reed ends up showing Peter a copycat of Spider-Man in the black suit that's like murdering people. And then he also tells Peter that the suit is an alien symbiote. But Peter already kind of knows this and is still using the suit because he's starting to get old. And so he's using it as a means to stay strong and relevant.
Yeah.
Which I think is a great way to sort of weave the canon into your story. I think it's awesome.
Yeah. It felt like that's a good place to kind of like deviate where mm-hmm. Of course he's older, like it wouldn't be as cut and dry, and he's a full-on scientist at this point, so he would know what he's wearing. He doesn't need Reed to tell him.
And it's kind of the first instance where Peter's trying to find ways to stay strong as he's getting older, so that's starting to play a part in the story as well. So there's a scene where Aunt May accidentally like wanders with the baby because she's kind of getting a little bit more senile, MJ and Peter fight about getting her into a senior home. Mm-hmm. And so that there's a scene where they're fighting, but Peter goes to get some air after it and is confronted by the copycat, which actually ends up being Kraven. And so they fight, and Spider-Man gets drugged by Kraven during it. And he's shot, and then he's also put into the casket where he's buried alive.
Yeah.
So, this is also the era where Kraven's last hunt happened. Mm-hmm. So, that's an interesting way to put him, into this as like a copycat.
Yeah.
But I think my favorite panel of like the whole series is when the symbiote actually notices that he's kind of in turmoil. Breaks out of the cage or the glass container they put him in, breaks him out. And so the scene where he's breaking out of the dirt, just kind of in reference to Kraven's last hunt, is brutal.
Yeah, I knew that would be a cool shot, like, because I wanted to weave Venom in during this era. Like, it was very tricky to kind of get get everything into this. Kraven's last hunt was huge. The Secret Wars, the symbiote, Venom's appearance. So to do it with this, like, that's another page where I waited for Mark to deliver that page, and when he did, I was like, oh, that's exactly what I wanted. It's so cool.
Yeah, But yeah. You also see in the graveyard that he's buried in, there's some people in the background that are also dead. You see someone named Bagley and someone named Zdarsky.
I know. That wasn't my call, but I guess.
Oh, really?
So Bagley felt like we deserved our end. I don't know.
You also see Del and Darmada.
The colorist. So
Del's the inker. And
Frankie Darmada was the colorist. Yeah.
Okay.
Who is also awesome. Like.
Throughout all this, it's.
The blending is so smooth on a lot of this.
It works really well with Mark's stuff too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
they complement each other quite a bit. Do they normally do work together, do you think?
No, this was their first time.
Okay.
Because we had to work out some kinks at the beginning, but it got really smooth after issue one. Yeah.
So Spider-Man becomes the Venom and goes to confront Kraven again. Mm-hmm. And so they're fighting, and Kraven appreciates how superior he is now. And as Venom, before it kind of goes into the kill, MJ comes out with the gun that Peter set as sort of like a fail safe.
Yeah.
Yep. And shoots him to get rid of the symbiote. and so that was kind of like a turning point for them. And so
I actually have a question about this.
Okay.
Is Peter Parker like canonically a Whitey Tidies guy?
Yes. Yes, he is.
Mm.
Yeah.
As he's growing up, he transitioned to something else.
Yeah, because of the page count restrictions, I was going to show him in his 60s and 70s in boxers, but
no, couldn't fit it in. But you're a boxer briefs guy, I assume, right?
Yeah, I am. Absolutely. Best of both worlds.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, if it did fit in there, I would have appreciated it. Got it on the same page.
I will say there are plenty of shots of Peter Parker and Tidy Whitey's shortly after him and Mary Jane get married in the comics, so it is canon.
I'm sure you took note of that and you circled it. So after everyone's okay, MJ takes the kids and leaves Peter alone with Aunt May, just because it's kind of a big turning point for them. And then the issue closes with Kraven alone saying that he's dying from cancer. But we see the symbiote with him.
Yeah.
So that's definitely a really cool pairing. Later on is just Kraven and the symbiote. I haven't read Kraven's Last Hunt at all, but is there any symbiote in there?
No, but it ends with basically this scene without the symbiote. So Kraven kills himself at the end of it. So you just the only addition here is just the symbiote wrapping around the gun and leaving it to the reader's imagination what happens. But Kraven's Last Hunt is awesome. You should definitely read it. It's
one of those ones where I'm like, I know I need to read this, but there's so much to read. It's one of those. Do you have one of those where you need to read it, but you just haven't read it yet?
I'm trying to think. There's a lot of DC ones. For sure.
Yeah.
I've touched upon most of the Marvel stuff. I can't think of anything off the top of my head. I usually discover it when I'm like, I'm assigned a book or I get a new project and I'm like, oh, hey, it turns out I haven't read all these. And oh, yeah, shit.
Yep. Okay. All right. So then issue 4. This is the 90s. And so we open it 1995. Peter's now the owner of his own communications company. That's Parker Industries. And we open on the scene where Tony Stark wants to take over the company. And they have a meeting at Peter's office. And Spider-Man says that the only way that that's going to ever happen is if Stark stops making weapons. But obviously Stark has the standpoint of his weapons have saved lives and everything like that during the Russian war. What's your kind of overall feeling on Peter having his own company later on down the line? Because it's definitely a big change from, when he was in high school.
Yeah, I mean, Dan Slott wrote a whole storyline with him finally getting his shit together and creating Parker Industries. Mm-hmm. So it seemed like a given that he would do it, obviously, earlier if he aged in real time. Mm-hmm. He actually, kind of put his mind to it. Partly because of the sense of responsibility to make the world better. Like, he has the talents of Spider-Man, but he also has the talents as Peter Parker. So shouldn't he do both? I think in his mind too, it was like most men have the usually wrong idea that to be a good father and a husband, you have to make some money.
Right.
And then the focus becomes that. Like, so MJ left Peter. But she left him because any sane person would leave at that point. Like, there's aliens attacking. Peter's missing for 2 weeks. Like,
they now have kids and everything.
Yeah, his aunt is being left with you on top of taking care of twins. Like, it's untenable. So really that should have been his focus at that point, like on MJ and his family. And so I think on a subconscious level, like, you start a company. You maybe all this money will take care of this situation. That's part of the reasoning for it being at this stage.
Okay. Yeah. And initially I was like, I don't know how much that, you know, I really like Spider-Man, like this kid that's trying to figure out school and stuff, having his own company, but it kind of makes sense. Like, when he moves on from like school, finally, it kind of still gives him something to like be late to almost.
It's true. We mature Peter a lot emotionally at this stage too. Like, even in his discussion with Stark, like, you can tell, like, he knows what he's doing now.
Right.
In the comics, he can never quite know what he's doing, or else he kind of loses that the youthful Parker luck.
Yeah.
You know. But because we don't have those restrictions here, we can show him maturing as a hero and maturing as a businessman, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cool. So
Spider-Man is now dating Jessica Jones, and he's also having her watch someone for him. Doc Ock is in Chicago, where Ben Reilly is. And he's, I guess, lures Spider-Man there because they know that he's captured.
Then Peter also fights Doc Ock after catching Ben Reilly, which I guess with that originally said his name is Ben Parker, then he... it's kind of assumed that he changes it to Ben Reilly, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So, so Doc Ock and Peter have a fight. He knows that he's kind of getting old and slow, but eventually he gets captured after saving some people. Did you have a lot of research that kind of went into Ben Reilly?
Well, yeah. So this is the biggest discussion, I had with my editor, because when I gave him kind of my brief outline for the 90s, he was like, no clones. And it's because he worked at Marvel during the Clone Saga. So he has, like, basically PTSD from working on that.
Yeah, I was about to say, it's kind of not received super well a lot of the time.
Yeah, I mean, there's great stuff in there, especially the beginning. But it got away from them. It became this story that they wanted to drag out across so many titles over so much time. Like, none of the original creators were on it by the end. Like, that's how long it went and how much it morphed. And so, yeah, so the editor, Tom, you know, I'm sure he has some fond memories of that time, but I think the stress of it all and trying to figure out a way out of it by the end was rough. And it gets convoluted. And so I had to show him, because you can't do the 90s without clones. Like, that was the big thing, right?
I was about to say, that's such a big part of that era.
So I had to show him that I had a plan that would pare it down, that wouldn't involve like thousands of clones and like constant back and forth. So I think it worked.
Yeah, I think so. There's definitely some like kind of switch around stuff that happens with it, but I think it's still, for the most part, very followable. But basically, after Peter gets captured, he wakes up with him and Ben Reilly strapped down in Oscorp's lab. Harry's there too on Ock's side, but Doc is kind of saying how Aunt May died and he needs sort of Warren's cloning research to accomplish some of his own stuff. Was his end goal there to try and make like a new Aunt May, or what was going on there?
I think for himself,
or just achieve something really.
That he's at the point in his life where death is pretty near. Mm-hmm. And so he wanted to have that technology for himself so he could be cloned as a, you know, in a younger, better body.
Right.
Which obviously comes into play later on by issue 6, right?
Yep. So in that scene, we find out that who we thought was Peter Parker is actually the clone, and then Ben is the original. And so there's a bit of a fight that happens there. Ben, or, you know, who's now the switched one.
Yeah.
It's hard to explain, but I trust me, I understood it while I was reading it.
Yeah.
He's kind of mad that he, you know, took Peter Parker's life from him and stuff like that. But a week later, later on, we find out that Parker knows that he's still the original, but Ben's walking around thinking that that he's the original when he's actually the clone. Mm-hmm. So Parker does his own testing, and they meet on top of a rooftop, and Parker tells him, "You're actually the original," and offers Ben like his entire life back as Peter with all the info he needs over like the last 20 years and stuff.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of his out as like Peter and Spider-Man, so that he can go back and live with his family and stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, he accepts that and they sort of part ways. Which I think is, you know, an interesting story. That's not really something that you see outside of anything Spider-Man, really.
Wait, yeah. Do they actually switch?
So Ben,
I thought Ben was like, "Oh, I got my own life," or whatever.
So that's, it's Parker that knows that he's not actually a clone, but tells Ben that he's a clone, and then offers Ben his life as Peter.
Okay.
Yeah, we don't know that he doesn't, like...
At that point.
At that point, it's for the reader and for all intents and purposes, Peter appears to be the clone, and he gives Ben his life to live. And mm-hmm. Peter is going to go off and basically be a clone. But then we find out later that Peter recognizes Norman's handiwork.
Yep.
And that he was just trying to fuck with him, but he actually freed him and didn't realize it.
Yeah. Which that scene's really cool too. So
the rest of the book is like the Ben.
Ben is acting as Peter.
Well, Ben, yeah. I mean, it changes obviously in the next chapter. The post 9/11 stuff.
Right. But
okay.
So basically like Ben, the clone, thinks is taking over as Peter, and mm-hmm. he is taking over Parker Industries and being Spider-Man and all that. Mm-hmm. While Parker takes this as an out, or Peter takes it as an out to go, you know, escape from all that and be with his family.
Yeah.
Ah.
Yeah.
Okay.
So you kind of know that from the scene with Norman Osborn. He's out of jail and sort of acting senile, but Peter knows that it's an act and kind of sees through it.
Yeah.
And that Norman manipulated Doc into capturing Peter and Ben. And so Norman actually ended up planting that fake evidence that Peter wasn't the original, which is what fools them, but Parker did his own research.
Yeah, because it's Osborn technology, so Norman mm-hmm. had access to make
yep.
it fraudulent.
But this is where kind of Norman figures out that Harry's dead, because mm-hmm. In that scene where they originally find out, Harry ends up dying from that.
Yep.
And so there's kind of a last scene with Norman where he tries to kill Peter with goblin gear, but then he also has a heart attack over it and ends up dying. So much death to come with
I
it.
I know. The scene where Norman dies is actually my homage to one of my favorite comics as a kid, which was like Captain America 300.
Okay.
Which was like Cap and Red Skull as old men fighting their last fight, like the super soldier serum's gone. And as he's holding Red Skull, Red Skull's dying. Red Skull reaches up to gently, you think he's going to gently like touch Captain America's face, and he just like drags his nails down it. And like, this is like one last thing. that's kind of what I wanted here, like,
oh, I see.
To get that kind of feeling of the hand coming up, but
Norman looks super old in this. It's kind of, you don't really see it in a whole lot of other characters, but like he's got all sorts of wrinkles and stuff. Like the panel where he says clever boy and there's just wrinkles all over him is It's awesome.
Yeah, because you figure he's like probably late '70s, early '80s at that point. Yeah. You know, he was a grown ass man when Peter Parker was 15. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. And then the issue ends with Peter going to see MJ and his kids, kind of happy to be relieved of Spider-Man.
Yeah.
So. Then, we got the next issue.
The 2000s one was probably my favorite, just because it's like the era of comics that we've been reading, you know, and
we're
more familiar with.
Yeah, so. I was able to pick it up like right away, like at this era. This is when, you know, Civil War is happening and everything.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was kind of interesting as a reader who started reading in this era, able to like pick it up a lot quicker, I think. Mm-hmm. But it's also interesting, this entire series, just kind of learning about Spider-Man's history throughout it, just because it can kind of be hard to go back and read older comics, just because they're so much different than they are now.
Yeah.
The dialogue is definitely different, like, mm-hmm. you know, 40 years ago.
Yeah, for sure. That was an interesting side effect of all this, is just knowing that some people will be reading it, discovering these stories through this alternate take on it. Like, that's kind of a bit of a head trip. Like, I tried to make it as new reader friendly as possible, which is really hard with all this stuff. The 2000s was kind of me coming back into comics too. So I started rereading Spider-Man at this era, like Moreland and Civil War stuff. Mm-hmm. I thought was extremely cool.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And that's definitely a big era of just Marvel in general.
Mm-hmm.
So we open on, it's 2006, and that's when the Civil War is happening. Morlun is he's in New York, and he's hunting down the original Peter Parker, but he knows that the Spider-Man that he's fighting is actually Ben Reilly, and he kills him. And Peter finds out about this through the news and is about to run off to kind of get Morlun away from his family, but he's actually convinced by his daughter Claire to just go straight to New York.
Yeah.
One of the things I had a question about is that in that scene, Peter mentions Ezekiel, mm-hmm. saying that he's a spider totem.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not familiar with that part of Spider-Man.
So that's a hard one. That's part of that era as well. So Morlun and Ezekiel. Ezekiel is like this older guy with the same spider powers, and he basically comes and he tells Peter that, you know, his powers aren't just an irradiated spider. There's like a spider totem. It's a spiritual thing. And
mm-hmm.
you know, other characters get this throughout the decades, and he's one of them. And Morlun is a character that hunts the spider totem characters.
Okay. So
it's like a passing reference to him, because I couldn't get that deep with it, really. Like, if I threw Ezekiel in and the spider totem stuff, we'd be like, what? Mm-hmm. It's like, it almost feels like too much of a stretch, even for like a comic series where literally everything is happening.
Yeah. But still a good kind of nod to the story in general.
You want to kind of
mention it.
Yeah, make sure that people know that you haven't forgotten good old Ezekiel.
Well, we figure out that like while Peter's living this life, he's kind of doing a little bit of Spider-Man stuff where he's like absolutely needed. So when they're living kind of in the city, he's still doing some stuff with Ben's mask. Did you try and have Peter wear Ben Reilly's costume at all during this, or?
Just the mask, because in the issue prior, like, we find out that Ben Reilly was secretly going around as Scarlet Spider during his time, and hands Peter that mask. So Peter just has the mask. So that's
right,
what he carries it with him, and he pulls it out when he needs it.
Gotcha.
So in that case, when, you know, when he flies to New York for Jameson's funeral, coincides with September 11th, which, you know, you have to touch upon in the 2000s, and also because it was a massive Spider-Man issue.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Cool. Oh, I guess that makes sense. So it shows that he's got his mask, but he's still kind of doing other stuff. And then he moves to Portland.
Yeah.
Cool. So Peter ends up going back to New York and kind of tells his story to the Bugle.
Mm-hmm.
He also goes and kind of tries to save Parker Industries, but he's met by Tony Stark, and Tony's still trying to acquire his company, but also tells him to register because it's during that period. But after he refuses, Tony decides to do it the hard way, and then the registered heroes fly up behind him mm-hmm. in these just awesome Iron Man suits. And one of my things, just kind of in Marvel, one of my favorite characters is Iron Fist. And okay, so seeing cool. his design here made me really excited when I was originally reading it.
Yeah, yeah, Bagley's the best.
So these were also designs that he was kind of doing on the go?
I think so, yeah. Like, you know, I gave him the list of characters and basically said, you know, we just have to armor them up. So it's very clear that Tony has had a hand in their development. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think with Iron Fist, like, maybe the only note I had is I wanted him to fully have a face mask on. So you can't tell if he's actually Iron Fist or a robot or whatever. Like, yeah, leave a bit to the imagination.
Yeah, and this fight scene kind of goes on through the rest of the issue, but Cap's troops end up coming into this as well, and they start fighting everyone after they try and get Spider-Man. And just everybody, seeing everybody age in this is pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
So this is where it's all really starting to become apparent, because Peter's old and Tony's old. He's got these big glasses and stuff on. So, yeah.
Peter and his secret identity were so central to the original Civil War.
Yeah, comic, I noticed that too.
That this was kind of my way of kind of bringing that into this story, with Ben dying and then it being revealed that Peter is Spider-Man. Like,
mm-hmm.
So a different way of going about it, but kind of the same result, where it ends up characters fighting over Peter Parker / Spider-Man.
Yeah, that was a really big thing in the original Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
So that fight's going. MJ sees the Peter Parker story on the Daily Bugle about him being alive and stuff. When Morlun shows up at their house trying to find Peter, they start to run, and there's like a fight that kind of goes on with Claire and Benji being there. But they find out that the ultimate way to beat him is to fight him while he's trying to like feed on their energy, is what mm-hmm. I assume it is.
That's when he's weak.
Yeah, that's when he's the weakest. And so so Benji goes back to fight him, and while Morlun is feeding on Benji's energy, Claire whacks him with some wood and kills him, because he's not indestructible at that time. So but I assume it kills Benji in the process. I don't know if that's ever strictly said.
Well, I left that kind of hanging until issue 6. In issue 6, you can see that Benji has a cane.
Okay.
In the beginning. I thought it was just because he's old.
Yeah, I mean, he's also a bit older at that point, but I wanted to make it so Claire is the one that ends up kind of...
being the hero.
Yeah, being kind later. Of the next in line. And that this was like a sacrifice from Benji.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Yeah. also, the new Spider-Man costume for this issue is kind of revealed. Kind of takes more of a heavier, like, black-colored influence.
Because mm-hmm. They're at Parker Industries, and then, like, while everyone's fighting, he, like, runs up the building and then punches, like, the right floor to where all the suits are. I think that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
So well, that's going. Oh, also... the way that they end up resolving that fight is that Peter kind of assumes that Tony has a failsafe for everybody in case all the heroes start to turn against him. And mm-hmm. so he's able to wipe all of them out with this failsafe in the suit to where it's just Tony. But then it turns out Tony's not actually even there. He's a hologram.
Classic bad guy move.
Yep, classic Tony Stark move. and then it's kind of assumed that Spider-Man goes to join the Resistance. And they all... leave with Cloak. I like Luke Cage's old design. He just has a goatee. I think that's pretty good.
Yeah, old Hawkeye is great.
Just an old guy.
Old Hawkeye. Well, they kind of had some old Hawkeye to go off of, I guess. I don't know if that was any influence from old man Hawkeye.
No, I don't think so. I don't know if Mark's familiar with it.
Okay. Yeah, he had like long hair, long gray hair, and then he's like starting to go blind.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Cool. Anything else on that issue, Chip?
No, I mean, this is basically where he realizes he's Spider-Man.
Like, yeah.
You know, he kind of has the back and forth and, you know, to be with his family or to not. And here it's like, no, it's who he is and he has to be this.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it kind of brings it full circle between him and Cap from issue one, which yep. felt good.
Oh, yeah. Yep, that's yeah. true.
Yeah.
Cool. So we're going into the tens. It kind of opens with the dream sequence that Peter's been having about the original day when he let the robber go by to eventually kill Ben. That ends up coming into play later. But it's 2019, so we're back to we're to the present. Claire grows up to be a successful superhero and a leader. Miles Morales is in the story now. Mm-hmm. Which, when I was reading this initially, I was like, oh yeah, Miles.
yeah. So,
they're tasked to go into space to take out Dr. Doom's machine that he has, and doing that will shut down all the Doomsday tech. So the idea is that while the heroes were fighting each other in Civil War, Doom had the opportunity to sort of take over.
Yeah.
And so Cap, Tony, and Reed are either dead or missing. So now Spider-Man's leader of the Resistance.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of stuff that's going on there.
and it's a slight allusion to, because I couldn't really delve into it here, but the Jonathan Hickman Secret War.
Right.
Where that's, Doom basically yeah. wins. I wanted to kind of have a nod to that without actually doing, you know, a universe-destroying event.
That makes a lot more sense, because I was like, so Miles is here, so it's after Hickman Secret War, but I forgot that Doom was like the big bad in that series, so that makes sense that it would be him to be doing all that. Cool.
Hickman Civil War is actually my first event that I read, and I'm like, is this what comics is? Oh my god. Like, yeah. It was just crazy. So much to take in.
And it was like, oh, the thing is big? Like,
Human Torch is the sun?
Yeah. That's pretty crazy cool. story.
Yeah.
Did you want to incorporate more of the newer generation characters, like Kamala or like Nova or anything in this issue, or do you want to try and keep it to like Spider-Man centric?
At this point, I mean, part of the reason to have the story set in space on a space station was to really narrow it down. Like, knowing it's the last issue and knowing what I have to kind of accomplish with it, I wanted to make sure that it's the characters on their own without introducing new elements, right?
Right.
So, yeah, it would be cool to, like, bring in the newer generation of characters, but really I needed to focus on Peter and Miles.
Yeah, it makes sense to isolate them rather than having all the new generation people.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
So the goal is to make it to Doom's ship to trigger this device that needs about 10 minutes to get powered up. Yeah. And so they make it onto Doom's ship successfully. But then the power suddenly goes out. And when Peter goes to check it out, he sees that his ship is blown up and he's met by Kraven, who comes back and he's now wearing the symbiote. So he's Venom. Mm-hmm. And so they end up having a really cool looking fight. And so there's a fight between Spider-Man, Miles Morales, and Venom, which ultimately ends with, you know, their helmets being destroyed and Venom gets defeated by one of the concussion blasts that Miles, you know, famously brought into Spider-Man, revealing that Kraven was actually dead and it was just his skeleton inside of there, which I thought was super dark, but it was a really fun idea.
Yeah, I mean, the whole sequence plays out a bit like a horror movie. You know, you're just kind of thinking of like the original Alien movie.
Yeah, definitely got some Alien vibes.
Yeah, I just wanted that, like, really kind of the, you know, dark corridors, you're in space and just lit by the helmet. And
yeah.
And yeah.
Oh, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, and like, I had the line, you know, all my enemies are dead, kind of like repeated up until this point. And that was just like kind of the icing on the cake, having it revealed that, oh yeah, actually they are all dead. Like, people that look alive are dead.
Yeah. Which makes sense. I mean, a lot of the Spider-Man villains are older than him. Mm-hmm. So now that Spider-Man's super old, it would make sense that a lot of them would just naturally be gone at this point.
Yeah, exactly. And also gives him permission to stop, like which is what this issue is about. Like, it's about the end of his journey. So knowing that his enemies are all dead, like, kind of gives him a ability to release from, you know, from all of it.
The title. Yeah. So then another big thing in this is that during the course of this fight and everything, Peter figures out that Miles' body has actually been taken over by Doc Ock, Superior Spider-Man style. So that's kind of where that era of Spider-Man fits into this, which I thought was really neat, because initially it was Peter that got taken over instead of Miles.
Yeah.
So
again, we tee that up a little bit with Doc Ock's previous Oscorp shenanigans with the clones, that he wants to live beyond his body. It felt like it made the most sense to, because he wouldn't take over Peter's body at this point. Like, why would he? Like, Peter's
he's
like
super old, yeah.
So of course you're gonna go for the younger Spider-Man.
Yeah, and Doc Ock has an interesting arc throughout all of this, just because he was working with Reed and Spider-Man in the beginning when he initially stopped being Doc Ock, and then kind of takes a turn again when he's trying to figure out all the clone stuff. And at some point he's like in love with May, because that was a thing that was going on in the comics as well.
Yeah.
But ultimately at this point he just wants to be a hero, but unfortunately he has to take over someone's body to do that.
Yeah, exactly.
So
they're fighting, and then like, Peter's like, why would you want to fight me or whatever? I'm old. And then, like, Doc Ock is like, I can kill you easily with, like, your body. I can, but it's more rewarding to beat you with my mind. And so then they, like headbutt him. And then they
go the old into, psychic headbutt.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm like, oh, my God, this is so much comics.
Yeah.
So now they're in this, like, white plane where it's just them. It's actually Doc Ock in there and then old Peter. Mm-hmm. And then it's just, like, you know.
There's a mental Sinister Six battle.
Uh-huh.
So we see. So
before this, like, that kind of the mental transfer, I mean, he references, like, Doom was the key. That's a reference to the old Fantastic Four comics where Doom is revealed that he could transfer his mind into other bodies.
Oh, okay.
He gets killed at one point, Fantastic Four, but he transfers into the mind of, like, this kid that's nearby, and the kid ends up ruling Latveria. Like, he was taught by this alien race to do this, and so that was like, yeah, it's such a cool line here, but I'm like, well, how else would, like, Doc Ock figure it out how to do this at this point? And with Doom taking over everything, I kind of thought just that one line throwaway would please fans of stories that I remember.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So they're on this, like, mental plane, and the Sinister Six comes up to try and just fight Peter alone. But the way they combat that, I think, is super clever, and he brings back, you know, the different Spider-Man designs throughout the decades. So it's like all the different decades are there to match up with the Sinister Six.
Yeah, so there's a couple things going on here. One, this is my gift to Mark for putting up with my bullshit for six issues. Because, you know, it is a very dense series, and, like, he rose to the challenge. And I always felt bad. And I basically was like, in issue six, half of it is going to be in a white void, my friend.
Yeah.
You can draw cool characters, and that's it. And the other thing is, by tying it all together, by having the different versions of Spider-Man throughout the series, it's my nod to Spider-Verse, which is also the big event, in the last 10 years.
Era. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it's also kind of nice that it ended up, you know, this story is being told through six decades, which, you know, is perfect to match up against the Sinister Six. Super clever. I don't know if you, like, made that realization, like, halfway through, and you're like, oh, this
no,
is a great way to
do it, but just figuring that out right now. Thank you.
Yeah, so it kind of makes it, like, an even match that there's, like, six of them now.
I'm smarter than I thought I was.
Yeah, you're like Hickman level, but you don't even know it.
Yeah, wow, I wish.
So they fight back and forth until
Aunt May wins.
Yeah, until Peter brings in a mental Aunt May, who tells Doc Ock that he doesn't need to compete with Peter for May's love because there's no limit on love. So that's kind of a nice moment that, you know, Aunt May brings into this. And Otto fades out with this, with the realization that with that. And so basically they have Peter and May have a nice moment where May says that all that Peter ever really wants is to save Ben. But since he can't, he chooses to save everyone else. Yeah. So there's a deep little introspective on Spider-Man's motivations and stuff. It's all kind of in respect for Ben.
Can I just point out too on this page, where, you know, May says save everyone. Our letterer does such a cool thing with the cricking and cracking of the glass, where he's kind of like embedded the lettering behind it.
Yeah.
Oh.
It's really, you know, there's little touches like that that like a lot of people don't notice.
I love lettering, honestly.
Yeah. Like, yeah, that's so. Travis Lanham did the lettering on this, and you know, it was very dialogue heavy. It's so word heavy, just by virtue of the fact that I have to explain so much, and the fact that he makes it all work is pretty amazing.
And still adding the creative touch in there. Mm-hmm. I recommend anybody listening go follow a couple letterers, just because they always post stuff like, how am I supposed to fit all this dialogue on a page, but they make it work and also direct the reader's eyes throughout everything. Yeah. But then also doing those cool sound effects in there. It's such a huge part of comics, I think. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's cool. I didn't notice that there was stuff behind. And in that second panel where that is, the lettering kind of gets split up because of the glass breaking.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's cool.
Yeah. So smart.
So they're back at the station now. The Doomsday Pulse still needs to activate. So they need to escape before that actually happens. Mm-hmm. Before the space station explodes to stop all the Doom bots and stuff on Earth. But there's only one escape pod left, classic. So Peter throws Miles in there because he can't let Otto, you know, kill a body that isn't his. And then that pod escapes. Yeah. And so now Spider-Man is left with the task of kind of patching up the ship as it's kind of exploding before the Doomsday Wave, or so that the Doomsday Wave can activate. Mm-hmm. But while that's all happening, you see there's a big opening in the ship, and then there's like a big like Venom wave that kind of goes over it. What was kind of the idea there?
That he's saving him. I mean, this is kind of a reference to Web of Spider-Man number one, which is where Peter first defeats the suit, where it's on him and there's church bells and like the suit like slinks away from Peter Parker, but Peter collapses. You know, his brain's just being turned to mush. And then the suit turns and comes back and saves him, because ultimately there's a love there for Peter.
Okay.
And so, after all this time, this is basically the suit helping hold it all together.
Because there's still that connection there.
Yeah. The you know, I wanted to have a proper end to that arc that wasn't just, you know, Craven's bones, right? Mm-hmm. And that page, just the three panel with the suit and then the close ups of Peter.
Yeah, and the shading there.
Yeah, it was very specific in the art direction on this one. You know, really? Just because I really wanted that effect of like sunlight kind of coming through the holes. It's almost like, you know, when you're under a tree and the sun's hitting the tree and like just the light dappling. Wanted that to be kind of the final shots of Peter.
Yeah, this whole sequence is like super powerful because he's also kind of imagining himself with MJ, and it kind of takes him back to when they were both young. And so that's kind of going on in his mind while this is all happening. And then when the pulse is activated, the ship explodes with it. But that line that you write in there, where he says, you're my heart, Mary Jane, you're my jackpot, before the actual ship explodes. Yeah, super powerful. Just because I assume that's in reference back to when he first met Mary, and it's like, you hit the jackpot.
Yeah, exactly.
I did it.
Yeah, these were hard scenes to write. And as the art was coming in, I get choked up as the art comes in, because it's like, oh man, working on this for so long and to have this pay off is just...
It's such a good payoff.
It's a really good feeling.
Mm-hmm. I have a question about this page. Mm-hmm. So back in the 80s, maybe the 90s issue, where the reason for creating the symbiote is a way for Peter to get back to Earth in order to get back to Mary Jane. It seems like there's some dialogue hinting towards that. Is there a way that maybe the boom thing goes off and then he jumps into the Venom net and then he could be okay? That's what I was thinking.
I'm like, there's a way, Chip.
It could happen. I think this is going somewhere.
You want him to live. In my head, this is his death. I did toy with that idea of the Venom suit protecting him from this, which wouldn't make too much sense because they hate fire, and that's what's happening in the explosion. But I thought it was important just to make sure that we know he's gone. And he this is the end of his story, and it's now Miles and Claire's story to continue on.
Yeah.
But if you want to be the still next alive, page, he could be still
the next
alive.
Page, it's all black, so that could be some Venom stuff.
It's true. I'm really addicted to putting black pages in things. Because it doesn't cost anyone any money, and it's just it's a da-dum.
And that's how you know, oh man, some shit just happened.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's the end of Peter's story, doing what Aunt May said, which is very nice. But we kind of go into this epilogue scene where we see Miles going to see Doc right after Peter's funeral. Mm-hmm. And he says that he's angry with him, but chooses not to hurt or kill him while he's in this medical pod to stay alive. Because that's not what, Peter would have wanted for, Miles to kill him and sort of take that into his own hands.
Yeah.
and then Miles goes to MJ's place and says that it's hard for him to wear the Miles suit since Doc Ock was wearing it as him and talking to his friends and swinging around the city and whatnot. So Aunt May gives him Spider-Man's original suit from the 60s for him to carry on his legacy, which great callback. Just kind of for it to start again, kind of for Miles to have his own life as Spider-Man.
Yeah, it was a tricky one to kind of nail down, because you want Miles to be his own man, but also there's something really sweet about being gifted the suit. In my head, Miles doesn't actually end up using the suit. He comes up with something different. Mm-hmm. It's just the act of giving the suit felt like enough. It's why I didn't have a shot of Miles in it.
Okay.
Because I didn't want to cement the idea of him wearing that suit. I wanted it just to be about the passing of the suit. What Miles does after that is its own story.
Right.
Yeah.
So then the last page is a callback to the first page of this issue, where you see the robber kind of running past Spider-Man, but instead of letting him go, he shoots a web at him. And it's kind of, to my take from this is that it kind of resolves it in sort of Peter's mind, and he's kind of at peace.
Yeah.
I assume that that's kind of the idea there. Very abstract.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's a good way to have the last page.
Yeah, it's Peter's subconscious is telling him it's okay. Mm-hmm. He did everything he could. He did everything right. You can let go now.
Mm-hmm. And then the old Spider-Man logo on the last page as a fin.
Just with a boop. Yeah.
Yep. So yeah, did you know kind of how it was going to end from the beginning? You said you plotted out everything, but how hard was it to sort of construct all of that?
I knew the arc in terms of he was going to die and then Miles would take over. Mm-hmm. The framing of that issue of the dream, I didn't know that until I sat down to actually write it.
Right.
And I'm so glad it came to me because I really didn't know what else to do to really give it to have Peter have the last word, but also be dead, you know? Mm-hmm.
No, that's a great ending.
Yeah. Thanks. So then that's the story. Really awesome story. I remember reading it as it was coming out. One thing that we didn't really mention was the covers, which is such a big part in sort of the feeling, I think, of the story. So these were all done by you, the original covers.
Yeah.
My favorite one being the 70s, just because I love that rendition of the disco ball and the pumpkin.
That might be my favorite. I went to school for illustration, and illustration is kind of about like being able to like synthesize ideas to create imagery. And there's something about the disco ball and the jack-o'-lantern
just fits so well.
Yeah, it makes me feel like I aced a school project. The one that's probably actually my favorite is issue 5, which is the 2000s. Yeah,
that was nice.
Yeah, you mentioned in sort of the back matter area that you were trying to keep everything as one color, but I think it works really well to have the red and the blue in there.
It made sense because it's about Captain America and Civil War, but also it's the Twin Towers.
Wow.
The red, like, and I wanted to make sure it wasn't like in your face. I didn't want it to be like
put
windows on them or anything.
So we
kept it super subtle, in case people got angry at us for evoking it. It was one of those things where I had the idea. I'm like, oh, this must have been done already. Like, it just makes so much sense. And I couldn't find any instance of it, you know, kind of post 9/11 Captain America stuff. So, so that's how we landed on that.
Yeah. And we like to focus a lot on the back matter stuff of trades just because it kind of gives you a whole different experience.
Yeah.
And I really like just you kind of going a little bit deeper into your illustration stuff. But we also see the variants, which these were some pretty awesome variants for the series.
Oh yeah, they were so fun.
Like the Greg Smallwood one, obviously, kind of references Archie, I would imagine.
Big Michael Cho fan.
Michael Cho. Cool to see. The 70s one is so tight.
Michael's is just the best because Michael Cho's got a very distinct style, and with this one, he couldn't help it, and he just like deviated from that and just went all Bob Peake 1970s illustration, and it's glorious. I would love a poster of that.
Yeah, that one. Yeah, just having it be the different eras makes it such a big opportunity to have like, you know, the sort of Neo stuff in like the 80s or the Todd McFarlane stuff in the 90s. It's really cool to call back to all those. Yeah. And then, of course, we got a sweet Scotty Young variant.
Oh, yeah. Always got to have a Scotty Young variant.
Yep. and then we see your first sort of run at designing the covers. Mm-hmm. And so what was you designed the first one that you put in the actual back matter. But did you have an idea based off this what you would have done for the rest of them?
No. I mean, it seemed simple enough that kind of the split screen, in terms of like
going from like retro to
kind of more realistic. It still didn't seem to play enough with the time aspect of it all. Right. Like, you know, this was a more realistic kind of look at it. But still it was very much a comic. So it's not like real. So it didn't. I like the look of it, but I didn't think it actually fit the tone when I actually started writing it. So I'm glad they kind of like they moved past this when I submitted it.
Very silent.
Yeah, and then your kind of redesign of it, you still didn't go with, but it ended up being the cover for the trade.
The trade cover. I toyed with a lot of ideas, which weren't in here. To do with time, like I had one where it was like Spider-Man's mask, but like the webs were kind of like the minute and the hour hands, kind of like
that's cool
moving along, but that didn't quite work. And eventually I just settled on this trade cover because I'm like, well, we just need a distinctive Spider-Man. That's all we need. Like, mm-hmm. we just need something that's like that you can see from across the bookstore and go, oh, I kind of want to see what that's about. I abandoned the idea of high concept for the trade because I'm like, I don't think it needs it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a dope cover.
No, it looks great.
I definitely saw it in my comic shop, which is why I bought it at that time, because I knew that we'd eventually do this. So you did it.
Nice.
But yeah, that is kind of a overall rundown cover to cover of Spider-Man Life Story. So
how we do it. Is there any stories or anything that might have been left out or last thoughts?
Not that I can think of. I think we kind of covered it all. Yeah, it was super satisfying to work on.
Yeah.
It was way too much work.
yeah, I know there's been a little bit of talk kind of like of what other Life Story things might look like. And I know that you're kind of like, you kind of want to read it as opposed to write it.
Yeah, exactly.
That does kind of happen again, which makes sense.
For sure. I you know, originally in my kind of my outline for a big Marvel Universe one, like I had a full kind of storyline to tell with that, which like one day I kind of want to do. I think that'd be a lot of fun, but it would require so many more issues. Like,
right.
I don't know how I could possibly pull it off. Yeah. I'd like to read more of them. I think that's where I stand on it right now. Oh, and I'd like to do the covers for them too. If somebody else was writing it, like I'd still like to take a crack at the covers.
That'd be cool. But, yeah, to kind of keep this general, you know, single colored kind of approach.
Mm-hmm. But also there's the instinct to kind of beat a dead horse, which these publishers, you know, do a fair amount of.
Yeah.
Kind of go back to the well one too many times. I like this because it stands on its own. Like you can buy it. You don't need to follow it up with anything. You don't need, if you've read Spider-Man comics, it helps. If you haven't, you can still enjoy it on another level. Yeah, because like Marvel especially kind of lags behind DC a little bit in terms of like trades and collections that stand on their own.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Marvel's always been a bit more about the serialized, and DC, you know, has these kind of bursts of greatness that collect really well.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, if they don't end up doing more Life Story, I think that's fine. If they do take more risks and do 6-issue things that kind of re-examine the classic Marvel books, so those can be on the shelf forever, I think that would be cool.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, like you said, it would be interesting to see like a Wolverine one, like you almost ended up kind of doing when you're trying to focus on a character.
Yeah.
But anything like that. What's kind of been the general reception of it as opposed to like your other books? It seems like it might be a little bit more popular.
Yeah, for sure. I think because it was different, and also, you know, Mark's involvement on art, and the fact that we made it look distinct with the covers, I think really helped it. I think I remember going to like a Marvel retreat, you know, several months after the series had come out, and they usually do a slide presentation on where the sales are and stuff like that. And at one point he posted about this series and he's just like, this is weird. He's like, it didn't lose sales. Like most comics, you know, start off high numbers and then they just kind of, they go down, right? Until there's like a spike because someone dies or a thing happens. But with this one, with the kind of the reorders and the multiple printings, like the number actually just like stayed the same and got a little bit higher.
Cool. Wow.
Which was like so gratifying to hear, just the fact that like we were able to retain the readers and bring in readers who had heard about it, and just kind of a word of mouth thing. And I knew the collection would be the kind of thing that, you know, retailers could sell a fair amount of, especially over the holidays. And yeah, it seems to be the case. I'm glad it worked. I think this is, you know, out of everything I've done at Marvel, I think this is the one that you know, people will mention to me at Comic Cons in like 10, 20 years or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, which is a cool feeling. Like I'm fine with that. You know, I don't think Mark Waid gets upset every time someone brings him Kingdom Come.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We just read that last week.
Yeah, which is awesome. And, you know, I think it's done quite well for him over the years, too, financially. Yeah. So, I'm not saying this is anywhere near that level of quality, but it just feels nice to have a thing that's distinct and its own title.
It feels like it'll stand the test of time as well, just because it's you don't need to know the stuff prior to it or stuff after it. I think even though it has a bunch of Spider-Man history in there, you know, you don't necessarily need to know all of it because you do a great job making it all flow while also like explaining all of, you know, what you need to know or kind of like the general gist.
Yeah.
There's a lot of different perspectives you can kind of take with it.
If you've never read any of the old stuff, there's like a ton of twists in this book.
I know.
I'm like, oh my God, it's a clone.
Yeah. You know, but... Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Well, that's everything I think we have today. Unless you want to ask any other questions.
No, that's basically it. Yeah.
Cool.
All right. Awesome.
Well, that's today's episode or this week's episode. Thank you again, Chip Zdarsky, for coming on, friend of the podcast.
Yeah.
We'll see you in 2 weeks.
Oh my God.
Next trade. Yeah. All right. Thank you, everybody.